Joanna Williams. I'm the director of a think tank called CIEO, that's C-I-E-O. I'm a columnist at Spiked, and I write for a number of other publications too.
Joanna, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. We're looking at the article you posted on that website about critical race theory. Why did you write it? And what do we mean when we talk about history being told through the prism of critical race theory?
So critical race theory is a philosophy that really seems to have taken off. It seems to have exploded into the popular consciousness over the course of really the past 2 or 3 years, but it has a much longer history. It began life in academia, particularly in American universities. It brought together scholars from law departments and also social justice activists and people working within other branches of the university. And it really represented both a development on the earlier civil rights movement, but also a fake way of thinking, if you like, about racial politics. And it really represented a more individualized approach to racism, where ideas about unconscious bias, for example, this idea that we have almost an inherent sense of our racial identity and we respond to other people in a way that treats them as racial beings, very much came to the fore. And I think it's been gathering pace slowly within academia since the late 1970s, throughout the 1980s and 90s, but it's really just in the past few years, with a series of popular books, that's meant it's really taken off. Books like White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race by Renny Edo Lodge. These books have really popularised critical race theory. It's become the dominant way of approaching racism in the workplace, in schools and in universities. And in terms of how it's used to assess history, I think it's essentially a very racializing ideology. So it tells us to see everything that's happened in relation to every aspect of our lives and every aspect of history through the prism of race and racial thinking. And so it brings to the fore concepts like colonialism, decoloniality, obviously the history of slavery, the rewriting of American history to start it off with the project of slavery, which was a major initiative undertaken by the New York Times. All of these things really foreground racial thinking as being the number one driver of history. So my problem with this way of viewing history is that it's often incredibly ahistorical. It takes the ways of thinking about the world which we have developed today and our current priorities, our current ways of seeing and making sense of society, and it imports those priorities wholesale onto the past, when that particular outlook, rightly or wrongly, was not shared by the people who were acting at particular points in the past.
But if we roll back a little, Joanna, terms like systematic racism, unconscious bias, microaggressions, they've helped in all kinds of ways for us to realise when we're, if you like, if it comes to a job application, we're appointing in our own image. It helps us to be more inclusive, doesn't it?
I'm not convinced it necessarily does, and you can take each of those concepts in turn and actually drill down and find some really big problems with each of those concepts. So if you take unconscious bias to start off with, actually accessing our unconscious and gaining an accurate reading of what might or might not be going through our unconscious minds at any point in time is an incredibly dangerous claim to make. Certainly, but there are very few neuroscientists who would claim that even by looking at a brain scan of somebody, and obviously people are not routinely being put through brain scans in the workplace, thank goodness, but few neuroscientists would claim that you could take a brain scan of a person and accurately observe and assess their unconscious biases. I mean, this is a fairly bogus, made-up concept, this idea that you can somehow measure and ascertain someone's unconscious biases. Of course, I think what matters is not what somebody might or might not be thinking, but actually how they behave in the workplace. What matters in the conversation I'm having with you now is what you say to me and how we treat each other and how we react towards each other, how we interact. I honestly do not know what you might be thinking whilst we're having this conversation, and I could turn myself absolutely paranoid and drive myself mad trying to second guess what you might be thinking, but that's a very unproductive line to go down. So my concern with unconscious bias is it's a pseudo-scientific concept with very little basis in reality, and it detracts from what actually matters, which is how we behave, not what we might or might not think. But unconscious bias is what drives the theory behind microaggression. And microaggression is this idea that it's not necessarily over hugely explicit forms of racism that are a problem in society today, but more the minor ways in which we interact with people from other cultures or other heritages or ethnicities on a daily basis. So if we ask someone, where are you from, for example, or if we assume that an Asian person might be good at math, those would all be examples of microaggressions. But again, I think this is not unproblematic. I think my main concern with the idea behind microaggression, which runs throughout my concern with critical race theory more broadly, is it racializes all our interactions. So I tend to say to lots of people, I don't know, where are you from? Because it's just an interesting conversation opener. People are asking me constantly, where am I from? And I know it's because of my very peculiar Middlesbrough stroke Birmingham stroke Canterbury accent. And so people are always, oh, are you from Wales? Are you from America?
But Joanna, that's not the same as being a black footballer who misses a goal in a penalty strikeout, and then you get thousands of tweets on social media that are abusive to you, or Marcus Rashford school dinners campaign. You have to admit there is racism in society.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I'm very, very sorry. Sorry, I thought we were talking about microaggressions. So you see, I would not describe for one second social media abuse as a microaggression. I don't think social media abuse is a microaggression at all. It's a clear and overt example of racism. It's absolutely not a microaggression. If you have a look through university and workplace guides at how they define microaggressions, the number one example, time and time again, is, I'm afraid, asking people, where do you come from? And my problem with that, as I was saying, is that it racializes people, and it makes relaxed, spontaneous interactions that should take place in the workplace become these very self-conscious interactions where we don't relate to each other as we might do just normally and informally and casually, but we're constantly meeting other people as kind of representatives of a racial and ethnic group. And I think that's a huge problem and doesn't actually benefit people or solve problems of racism. But to come back to what you're saying about footballers, you know, I'm absolutely not sitting here today denying that racism exists. You know, that's absolutely 100%, I cannot stress enough, that is not my view. I absolutely think that racism does still exist in society today. My problem is that I think critical race theory does nothing to resolve it and actually makes it far worse. In fact, I'd go so far as to say critical race theory is one of the main forms that racism actually takes in society today. But to go back to, again, to footballers and social media, you know, I do think what was very, very interesting about that, again, to emphasise not to play down the role of racism in society, not to deny for one second that racism exists. But if you have a look at the reports that came out a week after the Euro finals, where there was actually some analysis done of how many tweets were sent and where these tweets originated from, actually it turned out there were, I think, fewer than 1,000 tweets overall directed at footballers, which is obviously not a good thing, and it's not to say for one second that because there were fewer than 1,000, that's legitimate. But the absolute overwhelming majority of those tweets originated from outside the UK. Again, not to say it's acceptable, not to say it's fine, not to say there's not a problem. But you were talking about, I think it was fewer than 50 of these tweets coming from people within the UK. Again, not acceptable, not good. But what we had off the back of fewer than 50 racist idiots, racist thugs, people who, you know, deserve a clip around the ear and really need to be put right and told to stop being so stupid and ignorant, was a major national panic. A major national panic that made not just the front page of newspapers, but kind of pages 1 through 17 as well. Now, I think a society that blows 48 idiotic tweets out to a major national news story that runs for day after day after day is not a society that has a problem with racism. I would say it's quite the opposite. It's a society that's really characterised by anti-racism, and that's not a bad thing.
You don't deny the fact that throughout history, history is told through a white frame of reference and has been in schools. We've had since the 60s a number of equality acts, race, disability, age, gender, and those were rolled into the one 2010 Equality Act. You're not setting aside any of that progress whereby we challenge how we see history and legislate for a more equal society. That must be a good thing.
So I need to point out to all the listeners that I'm not a historian and have never professed to be an historian. I mean, much to my personal regret, I stopped studying history at school when I was 13 because you were allowed to do that, shockingly, as far as I'm concerned, and I very, very much regret it and wish I had continued studying history for far longer. But in terms of the study of history, you know, I think these things are always up for contestation, and certainly it's a truism to say that history is written by the victors. But I also know, just going from my own experience of having been taught history as a child and looking at how my own three children have been taught history today, that the teaching of history has really gone through quite dramatic shifts over the course of the past even 50, 60, really going back over a very, very long period of time. And the idea that children in school today are kind of learning about the wonders of the British Empire and the Battle of Waterloo and kind of the Spanish Armada and kind of amazing white people being victorious and the empire on which the sun never set is a bit of a fantasy. I mean, I'm 47 and history was not taught like that when I was at school, even though I kind of admitted to having stopped having history lessons at a very early age. We were taught about kind of projects on historical mysteries. Who shot JFK? Was the Turin Shroud real? I mean, that's what made up the stuff of my history lessons. My daughter, all my children, have had lessons at school that seem to revolve very much around the emotions and emotional responses to history. One lesson all three of them have had to do at school is to get down on the floor, sit on the floor under the desks, crowded in with all the other children in the class sitting on the floor. And the idea is that they stay like that for a long period of time. The teacher then calls them out and says that's what it would have felt like to have been on one of the slave ships going across the Atlantic Ocean from Africa to America. And quite what they're supposed to take from that, I'm not sure, other than very cramped, obviously, and you're left feeling very sore at the end of it, which I think personally is a little bit of a trivial lesson to make given the scale of the content. But the point I'm making is that the idea that slavery is not taught in schools nowadays is really a myth. These subjects are taught. The idea that there's a white supremacist version of history that glorifies the age of empire is also a bit of a myth. I'm not saying it is not taught in any school anywhere, but there have been major changes to the national curriculum and major changes to and major disputes within the teaching of history for school children that, like I say, are not recent shifts at all, but have been taking place over at least four decades now.
If we take the headlines this week, because race, as you've pointed out, is certainly making the headlines in terms of what some in the Conservative Party have dubbed wokeness. But the Rhodes statue in Oxford at Oriel College has been put up, and there's a new plaque. It alludes to how he exploited the people of South Africa. Don't you think that just balances out history and the impact of characters like Rhodes who give donations to colleges which go down the generations, but where that money might have been founded on slavery?
I think there is definitely an important role to play for balancing out history, but it seems to me as if we only ever learn the bad things about people nowadays. So I've just been doing a bit of writing myself, looking at the history of the Scout movement, for example, and somebody like Lord Baden-Powell is very much criticised nowadays. A statue of him, I think it's in Portsmouth, has been vandalised and been caused to have a plaque contextualising that statue, much in the same way as the statue of Rhodes in Oxford. The problem is you can say this contextualisation is good, but the contextualisation only ever tells us the negative things. I've not seen any of these plaques or any of these attempts to contextualise history that seem to make any allusion whatsoever to the positive things that anybody might have done in the past. But my own children have all benefited enormously from being part of the Scout and had different activities, opportunities to grow up and gain independence and have some freedom away from the family. You know, have really benefited from that movement. And I know I did as a child, and millions of children all over the world have benefited from that. And I think, to me, I agree with the premise of your question. I think context and balance in history are very, very difficult to achieve, but are absolutely things that we should be striving for.
And I know, Joanna, that you have, or you think, that social class isn't taken into account enough, in that we may all be sharing the same disadvantages because we belong to a class rather than a certain section of society.
Yes, I think that's undoubtedly true. And I think this is one of the problems that I have with critical race theory, asking us to see everything through the prism of race, because it actually overlooks some of the disadvantages that come with social class. And I think your social class position is far more likely nowadays to determine your salary, your chances of going on to higher education. Major facts about your future life are more likely to be determined by social class, actually, than by your ethnicity or by your race. And I think that's truly appalling that in this day and age, that's still the case in our society. And of course, it's not to say that race has no impact whatsoever on someone's life chances. Clearly it does. But I think social class has a much bigger determining influence on the shape of people's lives. And yet that's very much overlooked. People are not keen to talk about that quite so much or to think about solving some of those problems.
If we come finally to look at critical race theory, you clearly think it's gone too far and that it shouldn't be the only prism through which we judge our past and our present. But do you believe that it continues racism, as you said earlier, not end it?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I think it's an incredibly divisive ideology that separates us out into black people, white people, brown people, at precisely the point in history at which those racial divisions were being overcome. So I know it often seems like a cliche now, but if you go back and have a look at Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, for example, what was being said in that speech, I think, was the most amazingly positive and progressive vision of a future where racial categories are transcended and people are treated as individuals, judged, as Martin Luther King says, on the basis of the content of their character, not on the colour of their skin. And to me, that represents an incredibly powerful, positive, and a really aspirational vision for the kind of world that I would like to live in. Whereas what critical race theory tells us is that even to have that aspiration is racist, that if you claim to be colorblind, then you're actually racist. If you see race and judge people as racialized beings, then you're racist. But if you say you don't see race and don't judge people according to racial categories, then you're also racist and you're just a liar to boot. It says that black people are to see themselves as victims, victims of history, victims of racism, victims of their circumstances in both the past and the present, which I think is a real burden to push onto people, this weight of historical and present victimhood. And it tells white people that they are guilty, that they are responsible, no matter what their circumstances, no matter what their social class, no matter what their own ideas or outlook on life, just all white people are told that they carry this collective weight of guilt that they can never atone for. And indeed, even trying to atone for is to deny racism, to play up your own white fragility. And so I think it bogs us down in this ideology that we can never, ever overcome. It offers us no positive way to see a future that transcends race. It says race must always be the number one factor by which we judge everything that's happening both now and happened in the past.
And Justin, a soundbite, what's your wish for society going forward? How do we live side by side without accentuating difference?
Yeah, well, I would really like to go back to Martin Luther King and to really rehabilitate that philosophy where people are judged on the content of their characters, not the colour of their skin, where race, and I would add on to that, not just race, but gender, sexuality, all of these things are seen as like the least interesting things about a person. Certainly, speaking very personally, I would far rather people judged me on what I think, what I do, how I interact with people in the world, than make judgments about me based on the colour of my skin, on my sex, on my sexuality. I think those things are boring. I think they're the least important and the least interesting things about people. And my positive vision of a society would be where those things were just seen as, you know, either just irrelevant or just a kind of minor point of difference rather than these major things which we are told to divide us all and determine every aspect of our lives.
Joanna Williams, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. I look forward to your next article on Spiked.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.